Across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
On FM, digital and your mobile.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Good afternoon and Happy New Year. Welcome to the first flavour of 2018. And of course, thanks to Ian Dayborn for the last 2 hours. I'm Matt Bentman.
And I'm Alan Alder.
On today's programme, we look back at 2017, another really great year of food in Cambridge, and a year in which we brought you 142 food and drink stories, 25 news and what's on sections, and 24 Twitter news updates.
And now we bring you a selection of the stories, the openings, the closings, new foods, street foods, the books and the blogs.
So let's open with the openings. Cotto moved out of its premises in East Road and into the Gonville Hotel, opening there in January. Now it's fair to say that Chef Hans Schweitzer is world-renowned. Alan went to speak with him for our programme of the 1st of April and found out some of his history.
Now, talking about your chocolatier expertise, I mean, you have been named as one of the 10 world's best chocolatiers. And I remember reading a story about you making some miniature chocolate pianos for Pavarotti.
Yeah, that's the story. You know, when I worked at Sandy Lane, Pavarotti used to stay with us every year.
That's in Barbados.
That's in Barbados, yeah. That's the best hotel in the Caribbean. And Pavarotti came with his entourage, and they used to stay 3 weeks every year in March before their American tour. One night, he gave a concert for the island, basically, and it was absolutely fantastic. But after that, he wanted to have a party on the beach, so he invited 250 guests, and he said, I want something in a musical theme, and something many people never knew, that Pavarotti actually played the piano, and we had a beautiful baby Grant, and he said, what can you do? I said, okay, let's work on that. So I created the baby Grant piano out of chocolate. And it used to be, and it still is a big hit. It's not on the menu at the moment because I made so many of them, thousands of pianos. So I gave it a break, but people still come and ask for it.
So the 200 chocolate pianos weren't all for Pavarotti himself then?
No. It was a set menu and everyone had the piano. And ever since, it's been on the menu, really, because it's been so successful.
And there's also an extraordinary story about you cooking some Dover sole for Muhammad Ali.
When we took over at the Skyline Hotel in London, our company, and I was sort of introducing our kitchen policies, I had this phone call one morning and said, Muhammad Ali is up in the suite and he needs 3 or 4 Dover soles, but he doesn't want to come down because he just lost his fight last night. He just flew over from Las Vegas. So I said, okay, turn on the flambe trolley and put on a big pan, and I took 3 Dover soles up to his suite. And, you know, there was a bodyguard and some, you know, PR people. And they said, oh, he's in his bedroom. Just go in there. So I went in, and suddenly this lady jumped out of the bed with his red negligee on. And anyway, Mohammed, he came out of the shower and said, come in, don't worry about that. And so I cooked the Dover sole for him. And I never knew which sort of impact that would have on my life eventually, you know, because it was such an incredible moment.
Yeah, right.
One quite interesting story about when Her Majesty the Queen, she was coming to Barbados, and the Prime Minister called me. I was already here in Cambridge, and asked me if I could do the function for 2,000 people on Alora Court, which is the government building. So okay, I come over. So everything, sort of, we arranged the whole party, and we had all the different foods and canapes and drinks and anything you wanted. And it was sort of late afternoon, evening, 6 o'clock. And we asked the Queen what she would like to have to drink, and she said, I have a cup of tea. I thought, oh my God, one thing we don't have is tea. So the butler, he ran down to the kitchen and started putting on the kettle to make the tea. And he came up with this beautiful silver tray with all this, you know, teas and everything. And all he saw, the Queen, gone back into her Rolls Royce and drove off. And that was a very sad moment because everything we'd done was for the Queen, but the only thing she wanted was tea, and she couldn't get it.
Oh, that's really bad luck. Hans Schweitzer there from Cotto, which has moved to the Gonville Hotel in Gonville Place. Let's hear now from Jack Van Praagh, whose Gelateria is in Bennett Street. I spoke to Jack at the end of April when it opened.
There's not a lot of competition, is there, from high-end ice cream? Why is that?
You know, it's an interesting market. It's especially interesting in Cambridge. You know, there's certainly people that come in here, they look at the flavours, and there's not necessarily things, you know, they're not willing to take that step. You know, they want something that they recognise and they've had before. They don't actually want to, you know, make their experiences better, which I find odd, but it's you know, it's how it is. It's how it is with a lot of the tourists, and it's even how it is with a lot of people that live in the city. So that's okay with us.
Yeah. Do you think your incredible fondness for ice cream will sort of die away and you'll get bored?
It's interesting, yeah. I mean, it's a question I ask myself. I mean, I do things to keep myself interested. You know, this parlour, for instance. You know, I mean, every year things change. Every year, you know, we push forward in one aspect or another and have these new projects and these new avenues. And that's what keeps me interested, as well as my enjoyment of ice cream.
Mm. Are you
open or? We'll be open in about 10 minutes.
Okay, sorry.
But I'm sure it probably, yeah, I don't think I'll be doing this into old age. Yeah, but I like that. I like that it's, you know, it's going to be a moment in time, you know, a 10-year period or something like that, 10, 15 years. Yeah. And then...
And what might follow it? Have you got any thoughts?
I don't. I mean, I had... You know, I've worked in food all my life, but I've already had a kind of step change, I guess, since, you know, I was in restaurants for 10 years, and this is, you know, very different. You know, we work with food, but it's a completely different to a restaurant. So I like to, yeah, I imagine it will, I'll stay working in food, but I'd like to move into the charity sector. I don't know, we'll see.
Right, okay.
Jack of the eponymous gelato.
In February, I visited the Edge Cafe in Mill Road. Now, this is a cafe with a unique element, and the first voice you'll hear is Dawn Adams. She works there.
What's unique about this is the recovery element. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I'd been drinking for 2 years daily, and it had spiralled out of control, and I was on the bottom. Never used to leave the house. I used to live in the garden. By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was craving alcohol. So I took the step fixing myself, and I started it with the help of Inclusion.
Inclusion?
Yes, it's a place where you can go if you have problems.
And slowly we worked through everything.
I didn't want to go to start with, but people, when they go, they're so glad they've been.
And I needed something to do.
Don't be worried about it and don't be frightened. Just come and do it. Yeah.
And I found out about the Edge Cafe project.
Walking by, and the wonderful smell of the bacon caught my nose.
I've had lovely halloumi and beetroot ciabatta, lovely frittatas that you'll just see on the counter and think, I want that.
And I've been meaning to come to the Edge. I've actually passed by here several times, and I keep reminding myself to, oh, I need to stop in that little cafe and at least have a coffee.
I'm sorry I'm stuffing my face right now.
I'm sort of brown sauce, but it's not compulsory.
I like all the staff to cook, and I want them all to be able to make a cake, so I'm not so bothered if something goes wrong. It's still yummy because it's all homemade, so we often perhaps put something that looks a bit, you know, but I know it's going to be yummy and I'll sell it for less. And then, you know, we experiment a lot, like out of my sandwiches, I can't believe beetroot, halloumi and spinach with sweet chilli sauce just walks out the door.
People have helped me, and I appreciate it. If I can help anybody, I will.
It is, for me, a home from home, which is why I'm here so much. And know that you're not on your own, that there is always someone here to help. It's all right. You can see a future where there, at that time, there is none. And that's what I want to pass on to anybody that comes in here looking for help. I will not tell them what to do, but I will be an ear for them.
It's the little touches in the room which really make it. Little herbs on the windowsill for the cooking, to the nice little vintage coat stand, to then the local art, just adds a real sense of community.
People are just walking in the door and offering to do stuff, which is amazing. I think we've really hit a nerve.
We have Fair Share every Friday from Tesco's Newmarket Road. They give us items which would otherwise be thrown out.
Everybody who comes in here can have some of them. But I usually come for a look.
Yeah, brilliant idea.
Mm.
It's not in your face absolutely at all. It's just an ordinary cafe that will benefit for people that need a little bit of help.
Very nice. Compliments to the chefess.
You'll be coming back.
I think I'll give it a whirl. Yes, yes. Just make sure this wasn't the one-off. Bless you.
You know, I do love that place. The best soup I've ever had was from there. Now, next up, The Locker, a new family-run business. And here is the son, who's also the manager, Adam Hodges.
To start with, our coffee we get from Simon Fraser's roastery at Hot Numbers. They've developed this awesome blend of coffee for us. It's called Davy's Blend, as the cafe is named after my dog, Davy Jones. Dad had the idea whilst in Australia and went on a couple of how to open a cafe courses.
G'day there, mate.
G'day to you, Cole.
Right, you're going to show us some of these skills now, I believe. Out where the
river broke. You probably heard we lived in Sydney for a while and spent quite a bit of time hanging out in cafes. But it was John's idea, really, and he's wanted to do it for about 10 years or so. You know, things came into fruition, really, when Adam, our son, moved back from America and he'd been working in cafes in America and Australia and wanted to kind of settle back in the city.
You know, Adam's the manager.
I was living in America at the time.
It was Adam's suggestion to John, would they like to go into business together?
An Australian, like, coffee and cafe scene could be said to be a bit ahead of England's, like the artisan small batch brewed coffees, you could argue, started in Australia. So when I got back to England, I noticed it was starting to continue in that trend. So me and Dad thought, oh, well, we've got a kind of insight into how we think this is going to progress. So we thought we'd give it a go.
Funnily enough, Simon Fraser of Hot Numbers gave me a very similar story about 6 years ago. Again, his kind of eureka moment came from when he was going around the world, but Australia specifically, just like he said.
You'll have heard that we've been sourcing local suppliers, and my husband and John have been eating cakes all around the city for the best part of 6 months.
Well, our main sweet food supplier is called Ben Jones. He owns the Cafe Mobile. It's been going on the market square for a great number of years. He's supplied us with some amazing cakes, some really delicious gluten-free brownies with white chocolate and raspberries.
And the blondies, which
and
like
and the white chocolate and almond blondie. Yeah.
And raspberry, and they're like oozing with butter.
they're excellent. They're really, really
diet,
good.
They're really yummy.
They're stunning. They are really stunning. And they're not good for the waistline, but you know, it's a Saturday, you know, what do you want?
And he makes us the brownies and what else?
We got lemon drizzle loaf, a delicious like walnut banana loaf with dates, which is really, really excellent also.
It's great that everything on this road is, it's all independent. It's very collegiate between the different people here, yeah.
I'm Naomi Hodges.
And I'm Adam Hodges, so come down to 54 King Street and check out The Locker. There you go.
Cheers.
Thanks. Awesome. Thanks so much. Have a lovely day.
Thank you.
And those lovely days continued with the first of Thirsty's River Beer Gardens. Now, these are situated on the Museum of Technology site. Sam Owens has been running Thirsty, a beer and wine shop on Chesterton Road, for 18 months now. I went to his first Thirsty Fest last year, the food and drinks celebration. And he's at it again, with this, his latest venture, the Thirsty Riverside Beer Garden. What gave you this idea?
Well, you know us, Matt, we've done those events over in Body Works, and then we did the Christmas Thirsty Fest in Mackay's car park, and we like putting on these things in places where you wouldn't normally expect to find them, getting some great drinks and some great food and having a really good old laugh.
I came here on the first Friday night and it was absolutely rammed.
Sam, it's quite left field to think, oh, set up a bar here, but do you fancy doing this? And I'm like, yeah, we do.
Oh, look at that noise! It's a mini festival.
Yeah. They're all reacting to the sun. The sun has just finally poked through those clouds.
Ben arrives and the sun comes
and
out.
South African face.
This lady's from South Africa, who's come over here. This is Jill.
Nice to meet you. I'm not from South Africa, but this is my accent. Is it very good?
Yeah. Where are you from?
Johannesburg.
Johannesburg?
I commute here every day.
Great.
This is Thirsty Riverside on a Sunday afternoon.
We never in a million years anticipated quite the volume of people.
And the setting's perfect, and it's great to just have this experience near the river.
Seems pretty awesome at the moment in Cambridge.
Well, lovely they told me.
Yes, very much.
Yep, absolutely.
It's a good place to come.
Have you tried any of the food here yet?
Yes, so today we have Provenance here, and they have an amazing bratwurst, which goes very well with the beer. And I'm following that with some great chai latte from the coffee vendor.
I mean, half of the, you know, the food trucks now is seeing the, what is it, the skyline? This one from San Diego, I mean, it looks like it's from the 50s. Looks like the kind of thing my insane uncle in North Dakota would have in the case of a nuclear explosion, you know what I mean?
So you get a variety when you come here, you know, you'll always have coffee or something, and there'll always be some street food.
There were queues like going down out of the venue.
It's a very natural setting, right? Like you're walking along the river and then you find a very nice place full of people with beer.
You're in a good place, Cambridge. It's a lovely city.
I actually had the German Weissbier.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, the Oerdinger Weissbier, which was very good, as you can see by my empty glass and cup.
I'm sipping from a New Zealand pale ale, I think.
I don't actually normally drink ale. I'm normally a cider drinker, but I feel at a beer garden you have to try out the beers. And yeah, it's good. It's very good.
So, Ellen, the Museum of Technology, your favourite place in Cambridge?
Yes, I think it always has been.
I approached the guys here from the museum in January. Yeah. Asked them if they were up for us getting involved and coming along and organising something during the summer.
I was saying to Emily earlier, it's something that's completely aside from the university and the Cambridge that everybody knows. It's nice to have something different and that kind of Victorian architecture and something that's away from... It feels more like it belongs to the town. Because I cycle a lot, whenever I bike up by the river, when you come back into Cambridge, as you turn a point into Chesterton, the chimney's the first thing you see.
You know, you see the children playing here, families arriving, older people.
Young people and then us in our 70s.
Yes.
It's great.
Yeah, a cross-section of the community coming together.
A bit off the wall, street food, nice beers.
Lovely music.
Nice music.
Yeah.
Nothing too traditional, something no. Cambridge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thirsty Riverside will roll on all through to September.
Dankeschön. Prost.
A lovely summery sound. A new branch of vegan cafe Stem and Glory opened in King Street in November. I went along on the second day to see how it was going.
Day one, I mean, 8 o'clock in the morning we opened and we had a queue down the street already at 8 a.m. and pretty much continued like that all day long. Today's been kind of constant as well, not quite.
And are the customers Stem and Glory regulars or are some from, you know, the afternoon teas?
Yeah, I guess it's a mixture of both really. I mean, I saw a lot of familiar faces yesterday, but a lot of new people as well. A lot of people have heard about it. A lot of people have been waiting for us to come into town, I think.
And I see you're still doing cakes, which will, I think, delight a lot of people.
Yes.
But presumably egg-free cakes.
Absolutely, 100% vegan from plants. But we had a big tradition of cake anyway in our other location. I like to bake cakes myself, actually, vegan. Vegan baking is not as hard as people think it is.
And the result is lighter, I think.
It is lighter. It's generally kind of... lower calorie actually as well.
Yeah.
Healthier. I mean, we use a lot of where's a cake make, which is basically 2 parts water, 1 part oil, for example, rather than like all the fat that you would use in a sort of traditional cake. And it's delicious. Yeah.
And a great favourite of afternoon teas was the Caravan coffee. Have you retained that?
Yeah, we've retained the coffee. The Caravan people came up last week actually.
Hey, okay?
The London coffee mafia. By their own admission, they're bringing in the best coffee in Europe at the moment. So, and it is delicious, and it works perfectly well. We do 3 different types of non-dairy milk here. So we've got Oatly, which is a real kind of classic non-dairy milk. We do a coconut one and also an almond one. They all work well with the coffee.
Yeah, and so people who aren't familiar with that, with those milks, are taking to it well, are they?
Well, I think if people don't say anything, we just give them the Oatly, and they're probably none the wiser, to be honest. You wouldn't really know from drinking it that it was not cow milk.
Yeah.
A connoisseur, perhaps. I would definitely know if it was cow milk, because I can taste it, because I don't drink cow milk. But I think if you drink cow milk and then you're given the Oatly, you wouldn't necessarily tell.
That was Louise Palmer-Masterton from Stem and Glory there.
So, those are some of the new eating places in Cambridge, but we continue with our roundup of 2017 with some of the ones that closed.
Yeah, and there were quite a few, more than in a normal year. Now, is that just natural variation, or is there a trend developing? We'll see. Here first is Inder Bull from Inder's Kitchen. Inder, I think Inder's Kitchen started about 6.5 years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
And now there's a sign on your website saying, unfortunately, we have now ceased trading. And I know a lot of people have been shocked by that. And I wonder if you could say something about why that happened.
Yeah, sure. I think the first thing to say that I'm actually very humbled by, you know, people's reaction. I think people have been genuinely quite sad and quite shocked. And that's been quite humbling to know that at least, you know, while we were trading, we bought perhaps a little bit of pleasure to some of the residents of Cambridge. So that's been really nice sort of feedback. But essentially, we needed to scale. We needed to scale the business. We were really at that kind of crossroads.
You need to scale it, meaning?
We'd obviously changed our direction somewhat over the last sort of 12 to 18 months and gone more into manufacturing rather than doing the hot delivery. So obviously the sort of the chutneys and the ready meals, which obviously you're familiar with, and more recently the curry kits. And they were now sort of in about 40, 45 stores and outlets, including Budgens, in and around Cambridgeshire. And we'd also sort of been talking to Nisa Local, we'd got a deal with them. And we were also talking to people like the Co-op in East Anglia and also Ocado. And the reality was is that we needed really just a huge injection of cash to realise those types of accounts, because, you know, when these guys order, they order big, and someone's got to front that money and has also got to find, you know, the cash to put all the marketing and the promotional sort of expertise and input into it, and we just didn't have that kind of money, and we tried to raise it. We went to our bank for help, and unfortunately, you know, we ran out of road, so we had to make some very difficult decisions, but that's the reality of what happened. So it was quite sudden.
You couldn't have just kept going in a smaller way, carried on as you had been for the.
I think we probably could have, but really, you know, I think people's perception really of Inder's Kitchen was that we, you know, we were doing incredibly well and had loads of money, and you know, and that's not the reality really of a lot of small businesses, not just sort of Inder's Kitchen, but there's an awful lot that goes on behind the scenes, which is a lot of work and a lot of sacrifice and just really stretching cash flow. So, you know, if we had bad periods, say over the summer or over Christmas, when, you know, curry generally was always very seasonal, you know, those times kind of hit us quite hard. So I think if we'd carried on, you know, without sort of any financial kind of cushion, I think we would have got ourselves into a bit of a mess. And what I didn't want to do was carry on and then get, you know, another month, 2 months down the line, not be able to pay staff for what they'd done for us. And so for all of those kind of moral reasons, we pulled the plug. We pulled it pretty quickly because we tried desperately hard right up until the end to try and, you know, find a way to carry on. But you know, it's we ran out of road, and we had to do and wanted to do the right thing by our staff. So that's where our final pennies went.
That was Inder Bull there. It's a real shame, wasn't it? Alan, weren't Inder and Nick the first people you interviewed when you joined Flavour?
Yes, they were those years ago. And they had two Indian chefs, one of whom had worked in a very prestigious Indian restaurant in London.
Mm.
And who has some extraordinary spices that I'd never even heard of before. But yes, it was the very first.
Nazima Pathan's Cambridge Food Collective also closed this year, and here is how Flavour reported it on the 18th of March.
And we've had some sad news from the Cambridge Food Collective. They have suspended operations. After the success of their sales before Christmas, they had planned to deliver food from Cambridge's independent producers daily, not weekly. But it hasn't proved to be possible, and the weekly deliveries just didn't suit enough people. And without an injection of finance, it isn't on scaling up the operations. So until that money can be found, they are sadly ceasing to trade. A great shame for Cambridge food lovers and independent producers. There were two closures in King Street, not finance-related. Talking about them are first Joe Krasinska from Afternoon Teas and then a myriad from Clowns.
What do you think is the main reason behind the decision?
When you're thinking about a business and where you want to take it, there's a couple of options. Obviously, you can expand, or you could get a manager in, or you know. But all of those scenarios mean that I would need to step back and be doing admin, which isn't what I enjoy. I enjoy customer facing. I enjoy baking, but being in the cafe as much as I am is not sustainable for me personally. So there was no way for me to grow the business but still enjoy it.
So there wasn't a middle way then, really?
Not for me.
It was either hands on or hands off.
For me, yeah, I believe that is the case. But I think if you work in the cafe, you know, you'll always be the one that picks up shifts if no one else can. Yeah. Whereas to do it another way would be to get a manager in and step back. And that, to me, is not what I enjoy. I do the paperwork, but it's not the part I enjoy doing. No. And I just didn't want to go in that direction. Yeah. So.
This sort of full-on baking, which you've done for longer than 4 years, mm-hmm. you've been doing their cakes for a lot longer than that, have you?
Yeah.
Have you developed your cake making, or do you reach a plateau and stay there?
I think the problem is that I haven't had time to experiment with new cakes that much. I mean, we do have new cakes on the counter every now and again when I get seasonal fruit in, for example, but I don't have the time. Basically, we don't have time for failures because I need all the cakes that we bake. Today, for example, it's what, 2:30 in the afternoon. I've baked at least 28 cakes so far today. I started at 6 o'clock in the morning, and we don't have time to have a dud batch.
Yeah.
So I haven't had time to develop new recipes that much. So I feel that I'm really quick and very good at the ones we make.
Yeah.
But it would be nice to be able to have time to try some new things.
I used to work in the Champion of the Thames, come in Clowns every morning for a coffee, and, well, Jen would often try and slip a Sambuca in my morning espresso.
Feeling for me is just being in my village in the cafe in the evening. You just need to have the old man here having their beers and talking about football and screaming at each other.
Clowns is a cafe named after patriarch Raffaele's love of clowns and the Italian opera Pagliacci. His daughters, Jenny and Michaela.
To have a break of the headache from my mother, he used to escape to Clown to make tiramisu at 1 o'clock in the morning.
You know, when I came along here tonight, I thought it was going to be something kind of foolishly quite quiet. So I was really flabbergasted to see a huge pile of people and an outdoor concert. It's fantastic.
That day, everything was happening like a film, and then you rewind and you see Tom and Ari, they were playing like they used to do, Unplugged.
Well, I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do ya?
So they were playing the guitar outside, lovely guy, I thank you so much.
Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall and the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah.
There are people that 10 years ago would come in every single day, and they're here tonight, which is just amazing.
This is just a little piece of Italy right here in the heart of Cambridge, which I love.
This is community.
The family I have in Clowns, I'll never forget.
I'm going to miss my Aperol spritzers, let's put it that way. And the aperitivos. And my coffee. And it's the only reason I come into Cambridge.
Thank you to my father, he's our rock, our hero.
But it has a special charm of authenticity, I would say.
Thank you for always giving me a second home. I order somewhere to come, like, almost irrelevant of the time of day or night. You've been, like, my fairy godmothers and father in Raf's case. So thank you for everything.
Hallelujah, hallelujah.
Seeing that, how much care people and having Clowns, you know, right till the end. You appreciate it, it's like a blessing.
Now, that was first Joe Kraczynska from Afternoon Teas, and then a collection of voices from Clowns there, talking about their respective closures.
Yeah, and we very much hope that Joe will come back to the Cambridge food scene and at least make some cakes or something.
We
rather miss them. Anyway, that was a slightly gloomy section of the programme, but it's all over now. Let's move on to new foods. Dr. Sue Bailey joined the Flavour team in 2017. In April, she spoke of some new food ideas and followed this up in November with one involving chickpea water, which I still can't quite believe. So there's still a lot of research going on into new flavours or new ways of creating tasty products, then. It's a big deal.
Oh, it's a very big deal. And all the food companies that are out there are very keen to do new product development on the whole. It can be quite expensive, but this is nice when you can get student research linking in with food companies, publishing the results of their research and undertaking work that perhaps particularly smaller companies may not have the funds or the time to be able to do.
So there's quite a few people employed then in...
In terms of food product development, yes, it's quite an interesting area because you can either have a sort of chef background and go into it from a very creative angle, but it's interesting to combine that with a much more scientific understanding of flavour profiles and the reason why certain ingredients work well together.
You're more likely to get something that's tasty if you know some of the underlying theory, I suppose.
Yes, that's true. I mean, the food chemistry is a fascinating area, and knowing about ingredients, how they interact, how different types of substances work together is very, very helpful in terms of developing new products.
Right. So what other products are people working on?
Well, we've got quite a few students and some of them particularly working with me. One is working on a gluten-free breakfast drink shake and looking at different types of flavour profiles there and which is the most acceptable and the acceptable level of natural sweetness, not using any sweeteners to go into this because a lot of those drinks are in fact incredibly sweet if they're a breakfast shake type product.
I'm sure an awful lot of people when they buy a can throw away the water. Unless you're very good at soaking and pre-cooking your own chickpeas, again you're going to have some water with that. Canned chickpeas, you have water, but did you know that you can whisk that up and make meringues out of it? What you can do is use the chickpea water because it's got a lot of proteins in it from the soaked chickpeas and it will whisk up as well as an egg white would do. So if you're a vegan or a vegetarian, this is the most brilliant egg white substitute.
Well, that's extraordinary. Do you need to concentrate the water? Is it concentrated enough as it is?
No, it's concentrated enough as it is. It's absolutely perfect to use straight out of the can. So when you've drained your chickpeas, drain it into a container, into a bowl, and then go ahead as if you were making a normal meringue.
So you'd add sugar?
You would add sugar, and some people will add cream of tartar or a little bit of lemon juice, or some people add vinegar to meringues, a bit of white wine vinegar, perhaps to help it whip a bit more. You can do that, but you don't really need to. Yeah. It whisks up very, very well. It does take a lot longer to whisk, however. You might be whisking it for about 10 minutes. To get it to get to a really, really good volume. And it more than doubles in size. It about five times in volume. Yeah. So you need to use a really, really a big bowl and perhaps a stand mixer, a Kenwood type mixer, rather than a handheld electric mixer. Because if you do, all the meringues, it creeps up the blades when you're actually mixing it. But then you just add the sugar as normal and then cook it as normal. So,
is there any taste of chickpea in the meringue?
No, none whatsoever. No.
So whatever is responsible for the flavour of chickpeas, that doesn't
it's
leach
gone.
Out.
No, yeah. It's gone.
That was Dr. Sue Bailey. There are also some parts of plants which people tend not to eat, but which are getting a little bit more attention at the moment. This extract is from the 6th of November. It's vegetarian grower Kim Benn.
Chard stalks, if you get the lovely rainbow chard, you can get all sorts of beautiful different colour yellows and reds. And if you make a soup with chard or you add it to a stew or anything like that, as a garnish, you can just cut up very, very small the the stalks and just sprinkle them on the top. A, they're quite crunchy and delicious, and also they look very attractive.
All right, so they add a bit of texture as well as colour.
And definitely with a soup, if you've pureed the soup, then you can just sprinkle them on like croutons almost, or mix them with croutons, and they look really good. Just recently, in fact last year, I discovered broad bean tops. If you put your broad beans in the autumn, by the spring they're quite tall. And if you just pinch out the tops of the new leaves, they're very sweet and tender, and you can either mix them in a salad raw, or you can make a vinaigrette and mix them and have them as a sort of a side dish. You're also doing your plant quite a good turn as well, because it's the sweet tops that the blackfly love. If you pinch them out before they get them, then you can eat them before they do.
And what do they taste like? Broad beans?
They taste like broad beans. It's the same when you eat pea shoots. They taste like peas. These taste like broad beans. They're really quite delicious.
And that was part of a longer feature on eating, From Root to Shoot. And like all of our snippets today, they can be heard in full on our Relevant podcast.
We heard earlier about the closure of Inda's Kitchen with the loss of some good curries from Cambridge. Well, just before Inda closed, another curry provider started up, Neera Saini. Neera co-runs the Derby stores in Newnham, and her curries can be bought there and taken home for heating up. They are good. I really enjoyed the spicy potato one recently, great with cold meat, of which we had, and still have, a profusion. Neera spoke to me about her curries back on the 15th of April.
I always have either chicken tikka, chicken korma, or butter chicken. These three are very mild ones. And then I have normal chicken curry, normal lamb curry, and then loads of vegetarian ones as well. But
right, well, and what sort of vegetables are in the vegetarian ones?
Vegetable, aubergine, potato are really, really popular. Spinach and potatoes, and then sometime I put paneer in spinach. That's good as well. And I even, for the first time in my life, I did sprouted mung beans, which I did myself, and I added paneer to them, and people really loved it.
And your origins are from the Punjab?
Punjab, yeah.
Yeah.
Punjab.
So is what you're making, does it reflect
most
Punjabi?
Of it Punjabi style? Yeah, it's Punjabi style. And I keep on trying different recipes, different things.
Yeah. And always Punjabi style?
Always Punjabi style, yeah.
Right, so what's the characteristic of Punjabi food? Are there particular spices which are popular in Punjab?
Nothing that they use much, like coconut milk, or they don't add too much of sweetness into their food.
Right, and like what sorts of spices are in there usually then?
My main ingredients are cumin, coriander. I use quite a lot fenugreek. Seeds or leaves, they are very, very good flavour to add into any food.
And where does the heat come from then? Is from
chilies.
Yeah.
That's just from the green chilies. Right. I only use green chili. I never use powdered chili, no paprika, nothing. Just pure green chili. Just grind them and just use my own ground garlic, ginger. Only thing I buy that's ready-made is like turmeric. Everything else, I don't use any ready-made masalas or ready-made paste, nothing.
Neera Saini there, and no need to take Alan's word for the quality of her curries. Tim Hayward tweeted with really great enthusiasm about them too.
Yes. A food, well, a spice that's anything but new is saffron. It used to be grown at Saffron Walden, and now it's newly back in Essex, so on that basis makes it into our new food slot. A bit of a cheat, really. Here's Louise Wilson for Flavour, speaking with local historian Malcolm White.
Saffron was clearly a very important crop for the town to take its name from there. And indeed, it's one of the reasons why the town became very wealthy, why we've got the magnificent St Mary's Church, the largest parish church in Essex. Mainly on the back of the saffron trade.
Typically, it's associated with sort of Middle Eastern countries or Spain, or, you know, hot, certainly places that have a hotter climate. But it's unusual that Saffron Walden just seemed to have the right sort of soil and climate to actually grow saffron.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, it was only supposed to grow comfortably on the southern facing slopes. But in fact, the importance of the town was the fact that we're adjacent to the wool growing, the sheep growing areas of Lavenham and Suffolk and what have you. And of course, the crocus was used as a dye for the wool.
Because that's how it started out, isn't it? The wool industry was actually kind of what it was mostly known for before
that,
wasn't it?
And it was a dye to colour the wool and to provide an alternative to presumably dull grey and white colours.
Now, street food is still fiercely popular in Cambridge, and the food park scene draws in the crowds especially. Now, we've covered a fair few over the last 12 months, from Joe Herbert's Doses and Esther Game's Kombucha Teas, and here's a couple I enjoyed recording with. And this was back when it was sweltering hot over the June-July months.
Four seasons in one day.
This job is heaven in summer and hell in winter. And people always say to us, oh, coffee, oh, it's a cold day. That must be your best days. But actually, no, it's not. Nice weather, people sitting outside. That's when people drink tea and coffee. So
this is Andy and Hannah Clark. They run the Rural Coffee Project, which is one of the latest street food vans to appear in Cambridge.
This is our special on today. Moroccan mint, which we grow at home, with Kandula green tea, which is Ceylon green tea. And there's a bit of sugar in there as well, because that's what the Moroccans do. If you've ever been there and had their tea, it's quite sweet.
This is lovely and smooth, very relaxing, instantly calming.
You know, this is a very high quality green tea, so you've got a lot of antioxidants and everything in there. And then you've got that fresh mint in there as well, which gives that really fresh flavour. People say that our coffee is one of the only coffees that they have without sugar, because it's actually sweet enough, not too bitter, not too acidic. It's actually sweet enough to drink without sugar, so people really like that.
Today we had a selection of homemade date flapjacks and double chocolate brownies, which we cooked this morning. Every morning we try and bake as freshly as we can.
You know, that rural farmhouse, rustic sort of cake.
We actually find that our busiest period is when everyone's had their food. So we definitely get a later rush compared to everyone else.
The reason that we've done the Rural Coffee Project in the way that we have is because it is us. It is true to who we are. We are outdoorsy, rural people, and although we enjoy going into the city and experiencing all that, we always like to come back to the more rural areas. So.
Coffee, cakes, flapjacks, tea, and a sheepdog. Oh, and a reference to my dodgy radio editing.
Touch my Land Rover and die.
You probably said that anyway.
Yeah, I did.
Crumbling like pastries, they scream, the worst things in life come free to us.
And now for something quite different, Sri Lankan and Southern Indian street food, courtesy of Kura Kura.
We've been together 10 years. It was way before I wanted to do street food, because I was looking at getting a tricycle and doing satays on it. Oh, yeah. No health and safety involved whatsoever. I was going to have a grill on the front of a tricycle pedalling around Cambridge. No common sense either. But Sri Lankan food and Southern Indian food, that's really where my passion lies. And I do think you need that, particularly in street food. You can't just do it because it makes dosh. You know, that's, you know, then you might as well have a burger van. A normal burger van, not steak and honour. You know, you might as well go sell cheap burgers. That's probably what I'm saying. We sell the quintessential Sri Lankan street food dish of kottu roti, a very thin flatbread.
He chops that on the hot plate with Sri Lankan Kodamba roti bread.
Here comes a noisy bit. Chopped to oblivion on a hot plate with leeks, red onion, white cabbage, carrot.
And an egg.
An egg gets chopped into it.
All chopped together.
And then our special Sri Lankan chicken curry gets mixed and chopped through that as well.
I find that very Moorish.
With Sri Lankan food in particular, it's not just about that dull thump of heat. The flavours are so complex. Well, the spices, we do a roasted spice mix, which is the sort of forms the basis of our flavour profile, if you like. And within that, there's green cardamom, cinnamon, cloves, fenugreek, fennel.
Mustard seed.
Black mustard seed. There's cumin, coriander.
Black peppercorn.
So there, you know, there's so much flavour there. To just wallop that with a load of dry chilli is, you know, it seems pointless. Mm. So we allow those flavours come through by pitching the curries at a relatively low heat. There is dried red chillies in there, which we add, but we just reduce it. And it means it's quite child friendly as well. We do sell a lot of, you know, kiddies portions or feed lots of the kiddies. So the curries are sort of inherently mild to medium. I say mild, Louise says medium. I like chilies, Louise doesn't. For the people that really don't like any heat, we serve with a yogurt raita as well, which can cool it right back.
Just to put out the fire.
We'd been
planning on doing this anyway. We'd been building the trailer, as I say, for a year. But it was always going to be a kind of Saturday thing, just to release that passion for cooking, I suppose, for both of us, you know, an outlet. We've always cooked, even when we had a dance class, we used to cook at that. So this was always on the cards, and it was that kind of sit back and wake up and think moment. This was something we always wanted to do.
What's inspired the name Kurakura? Because when I looked it up, it meant turtle or tortoise.
Yeah, well, apparently in Polish it means chicken. And you're right, in Malaysian it means sea turtle. When we were looking at doing this just as a sort of Saturday thing, doing snacks from South India and Sri Lanka, vadas, bhajis, so we were looking at different connotations of, you know, what these foods are, and even the vadas, they're quite crispy, succulent. So we're looking at words like succulent, crispy. So good old Google informed us that in Gujarati, crispy is kurakura. It isn't, because my mate speaks Gujarati, and after we registered it, because it is a registered brand, and after we named the company, he went, what's it mean then? I went, well, you speak Gujarati, you tell me. He went, nothing, doesn't mean anything. So long answer, as it always is from me, it is a total mistranslation, but we just loved it, so we stuck with it. It's us, it's Kurakura.
Yeah, we are Kurakura.
Yeah. Confused the meaningless.
Robin and Louise from Kurakura, whatever it means. In 2017, Flavour continued its tradition of looking at food books and blogs. Here is Sarah Lavelle from Quadrille Press on a particularly interesting book, Citrus, by Catherine Phipps.
Yes, Citrus is the third book from Catherine Phipps, who is a phenomenally talented cookery and recipe writer. When she started looking at citrus and various different types, it became clear that it's such an extraordinary ingredient, one that we're generally familiar with, but it's, you know, you put some over raw fish and it makes it edible. It's like, you know, ceviche, it cooks it, and one squeeze in a sauce or a can totally change the taste of it, or in salad dressings. And so citrus looks at the fruits we're most familiar with, but also more obscure ones, things like yuzu, bergamot, and maybe the sort of fruits that we're all familiar with at Christmas, like satsumas and tangerines, but how you use them in cooking. So it's absolutely packed with recipes. We've got over 170 recipes in here. All her recipes use every bit of citrus. She even deep fries citrus slices as a snack, which is quite interesting. Right. But the zest particularly, she does, it's almost like a natural sweet. She very finely shredded zest, she boils it up and then cooks it in a sugar syrup and then mixes it with a little bit of citric acid, and what you get is the equivalent of those really sour fizzy sweets. I mean, really kind of mouth numbingly sour. They're absolutely brilliant. And when we did the photo shoot and she brought a whole box of this candied citrus zest along, I just could not stop eating it. I was just addicted, and I must have been eating it for across about an hour, and then I discovered I couldn't actually talk anymore because my mouth had gone so numb. It was fantastic. And yeah, it covers everything. There's a beautiful salad, there's a coconut, lime and lemongrass chicken salad that my colleagues at work were raving about when someone made it. And there's a gorgeous pavlova, which is bergamot and Turkish delight pavlova. It's just beautiful.
Sarah also joined us in the studio with food writer Tim Hayward of Fitzbillies in the Financial Times to talk about his new book, The Modern Kitchen.
I'm sometimes slightly aware that we have some odd things in our kitchens. I mean, gravy boats, for example. I mean, even the name is a bit peculiar, isn't it? But when you see the book, somehow it takes the subliminal feeling of something, there's something ridiculous here, and actually brings it out. There are so many items in that book which are subject specific, aren't there? You know, like a gravy boat, a butter dish. Maybe have any number of dishes we could put. A salt pig.
Well, I think the story of the domestic kitchen from the point at which it... The cut-off point for me, the starting point here, was when we stopped having kitchens that had servants. And the kitchen becomes the thing that you own and operate yourself as a householder, as a cook or a whatever it might be. And consequently, it immediately swaps over from... I found some old catalogues of kitchen equipment from before this changeover period. And you could imagine that the lord or lady of the house would have sat down at the table with the cook and discussed whether or not a potato peeling machine would have been, you know, financially viable or sensible for what they were doing. It would have been like ordering a piece of farm machinery. Is this one going to last us a good long time? Is there a cheaper one? What's the throughput of potatoes? And it's that kind of decision-making process. The minute you get past the sort of between the wars period, and you've mainly got, it is mainly women, mainly working in their own kitchens, you start being able to sell to them in a way that's much more around sort of fast-moving consumer goods stuff. You know, you start getting built-in obsolescence, but also this idea of segmenting the market and creating needs around certain areas. So, yeah, you've probably got three jugs in your kitchen, any one of which will be good for gravy. On the other hand, if you can suddenly persuade people that actually, you know, posh people have gravy boats, you know, and you've got a separate kind of, and you've sold another object, and you've suddenly got four jugs on the shelf. And the more and more and more of that subdivision and specialisation is actually, it's what's happened in all consumer manufactured products in that post-war period.
And a couple of really surprising things. Vincent Price did a cookery programme.
Vincent Price did a cookery programme in the UK. That's the really, really odd thing. It was a low point of his career. And he came over here, he made a couple of Hammer movies, including The Amazing Theatre of Blood, which I think you've probably agree is the...
I'm a big fan.
A big fan of Theatre of Blood. It is the greatest horror movie ever made. And he also made this... And it's made for Central Television, I think. And there's only one... 2-inch tape of it, and it's in the British Film Institute. You have to sign in and go into a little room in the basement to the one machine left that will play 2-inch tape. And it's only got two people on the credits. You know, the cameraman, director, and the company that supplied the flatpack kitchen for the set. And it's unbelievably sort of subdelia. But he's doing these amazing dishes. Yeah, marvellous man.
Are there books? Are there cookbooks?
There is cooking price-wise is if you ever find it, it's only available in paperback, and it's got him on the front gurning horribly, and he's got a silk scarf around his neck, tied off the little ring, which is just lovely, and then the dishes are all influenced by his life as a travelling gourmet and celebrity.
Tim Hayward and Sarah Lavelle with an extract from a much longer feature that was broadcast on the 28th of October. And you can listen to the whole thing again on the podcast.
Sue Bailey did a series of features about blogs. This is an extract from her talk with Miss Sue Flay. It's from the programme of the 18th of February.
Has blogging brought you amazing opportunities or experiences?
Because I've built up an expertise in afternoon tea and the etiquette of afternoon tea, I've been invited to do a lot of TV work. So I've filmed with Nigel Slater, I've been on the BBC One show, I've filmed for BBC's Escape to the Country, I've filmed with Alan Titchmarsh. I've done some very bizarre, random things, and it's just been really good fun. Yeah. I've had recipes printed in baking books, you know, the list goes on. It's just been really good fun.
And this is all as a result, really, of your blog, or you going actively to seek these people?
Yeah, I think most of the TV and the radio appearances have been people coming to me, and I guess, you know, nobody should undervalue what they do and what they can offer. But, you know, they want me for my expertise, and that's what I've built up. So it's, you know, it's important to learn and be able to teach other people.
And that was Jo Christie, better known as Miss Souffle, talking with Dr. Sue Bailey back in February. And it's incredible how well things developed for her out of that blog.
Isn't it?
Yes. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
And that completes our roundup of 2017. Many thanks to everyone who's been part of the programme, as a presenter, an interviewer, or as a guest. And Dave Fox has won the prize for the most appearances with his extremely helpful advice to growers. And Dave will be back with us in 2018, we are pleased to say.
We'd also like to give a shout out to Ruth Reyes, ex of our team, who left Cambridge and the UK and Flavour to flee from Brexit and to take up a new life in Barcelona. We do hear from Ruth from time to time, and she's having a good time there, but we do miss her.
Yeah, we certainly do.
On to the Cambridge food and drink news now. We begin as usual with jobs.
Rice Boats, the Carolan restaurant in Newnham Road, is looking for waiting staff. The pay is £7.50 an hour, plus tips, and the hours are 12.15 to 2.30 and 6 to 10.30. Pop in any day after 6pm to chat, or you can phone Cambridge 302 800 or email info@riceboats.co.uk. And the Red Bull in Barton Road, also in Newnham, is looking for bar staff, full and part-time. Just apply at the bar. Also, Relevant Records Cafe is looking for an assistant manager, and you can find full details on their website.
News from the Three Horseshoes in Madingley. You may remember that the restaurant was taken over by Huntsbridge, owners of the Old Bridge Hotel in Huntingdon, a while ago. Well, Huntsbridge is moving on and moving out, and on the 22nd of January, the new owners will be Cam's Cuisine, owners of Smokeworks, Millworks, the Cambridge and St John's Chop Houses, and others. Before that happens, there is a special offer of a three-course Italian-themed menu for £24, or two courses for £18.50, and that includes a drink. This offer ends on the 20th of January and excludes Saturday evenings and Sunday lunchtimes. Booking can be done online.
La Latina Bustorante is serving its South American food from its double-decker bus today in the Cambridgeshire Retail Park off Newmarket Road, and that's until 9pm. And Calvary's Brewery in Hooper Street is open now, serving its excellent beers and Neapolitan street food. That's from right now till 3pm today, and again from 6 till 9 tonight, though the beer will be available all day until 10.30.
There's a sale at Pine Shop in Pease Hill, £10 off every £30 you spend up to the 11th of January. Pick up a sale card when you're next there.
And finally, coming up at the Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton Road on the 16th of January, there's a Spanish wine tasting. Lots of lovely Spanish nibbles. It's from 7 till 10pm and costs £20.
That's all we have for you today. We'll be back on the 20th of January. Until then, you can listen to this edition again, either on the repeat tomorrow at 2pm, our new user-friendly repeat slot, 2pm on Sunday, or on the podcast available early next week.
And remember, you can email us flavour@cambridge105.co.uk, or you can follow us on Twitter at flavour105.
Coming up on Cambridge 105 Radio this afternoon after the news at 1pm, Arts Roundup. Simon Burton returns with a new series of this excellent art show. And today, it includes a visit to the Degas exhibition at the Fitzwilliam Museum.
At 2pm, it's Cambridge Wishlist, another chance to hear Cambridge MP Daniel Zeichner's choice of 10 music tracks and chat about his life with Tony Barnfield.
From 3 till 5, Saturday Sport, 5 till 6, 105 this week, 6 till 7, the Saturday Soul Show with Mike Pryor, and from 8 till 10, Rock of Ages with Paul Cristoforo.
So that's all from us. Thanks very much for listening, and until the 20th of January, goodbye.